Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, glorious notes from Mozart echoing across the basilicas of Rome this weekend. An opportunity to shine the spotlight of one of the greatest musical geniuses of all time. And in our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Father Foster helps me write a postcard from St. Peter's Basilica. Exclusively Latin, of course. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Music has the capacity to elevate the soul to contemplation. Those were Pope Benedict XVI's words earlier in the year during a brief talk after a concert here in Rome, one of the very many to mark the 250th anniversary of the birth of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. On this solemn occasion, which also marked Rome's birthday, the Pope, who, as we know, has played the piano since his youth, called the music delightful, adding how many of Mozart's works, in particular the Ave Verum, were an invitation to prayer. This weekend here in Rome, the sound of Mozart's music will echo across three of its great basilicas. Taking place in Rome is the fifth International Festival of Sacred Music, in fact, and scheduled concerts are on Friday in the Pope's Cathedral of St. John Lateran, on Saturday in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls, and on Sunday when, during a morning mass in St. Peter's itself, presided over by the Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna, Christoph Schönborn, the Basilica will be filled with the notes of Mozart's Incoronation Mass. And it's with these inspiring notes that I wish to begin today's broadcast, focusing in a special way on this great musical genius, one of the greatest of all times. I do so with a music historian, a familiar guest on my programme. You may have guessed his name, Monsignor Philip Whittemore. Stay tuned and take a deep breath.
Music, maths, and chess. Those are said to be the three areas where you find child prodigies, able even at a tender age to perform as well as the great masters. This year, we're celebrating the 250th anniversary of the birth of one of the greatest child prodigies of all time, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, born in Salzburg in January 1756. I don't know what he was like at maths, and I don't know whether he played chess, but his musical accomplishments from early childhood on are legendary. By age 14, he'd already composed about 100 works, and he continued producing about 25 each year until his death just over 20 years later. The piece we've been listening to was written on a visit to London when the composer was 9 years old. The autograph manuscript is kept in the British Library. The Mozart family spent 15 months in London. This was just one of the many tours arranged by Wolfgang's father Leopold to show off the amazing talent of his young son and his daughter Nannerl. The children were taken to the leading cities of Europe and to the courts of kings and princes. They took Europe by storm. There's a well-known story about Mozart's visit to Rome as a young lad of 14. He heard the Sistine Choir singing Allegri's Miserere. In those days, so the story goes, it wasn't possible to get hold of the music. Only the Sistine Choir had copies of it. But the 14-year-old Mozart heard it performed once and then wrote the whole piece down from memory. The secret was out. That story isn't as far-fetched as it might seem. Allegri's Miserere is quite repetitive, and for a receptive young musical mind, it's not impossible to imagine being able to commit the whole piece to memory. Though, I must admit, I wouldn't have wanted to be set an exercise like that when I was taking my final exams in music. That sort of childhood is bound to leave its mark. From a musical point of view, it meant that Mozart was exposed to the stimulus of a wide range of different styles, all of which he was able to assimilate into his own mature style. J.S. Bach picked up the style of French and Italian music by painstakingly copying manuscripts. Mozart picked it up by travelling all over the continent and hearing the music at first hand. Nowadays, I think most people would question whether a childhood like that was really a good way to prepare for adult life. Things began to go wrong for young Wolfgang quite early. It was hard for him to settle in Salzburg, where he and his father were court musicians of the Prince Archbishop. The Archbishop didn't really appreciate the immense talent of his young servant. At the age of 21, Mozart set off on his travels again, accompanied by his mother. First to Mannheim, where Mozart fell in love with a young singer, Aloysia Weber, but his hopes of marriage were disappointed. So too were numerous attempts to find more suitable employment at various princely courts. On they went to Paris, where Mozart's mother took ill and died. The break from an increasingly difficult situation in Salzburg came in 1781, by which time Mozart was 25 years old. He was able to establish himself in Vienna, where the opportunities for a freelance musician were much greater. He married Constanze Weber, younger sister of his first love, Aloysia. And he made himself popular in Vienna by composing an opera in the German language, the kind of thing the Emperor Joseph II liked to encourage. Und ein Freudenliedchen singen, denn nun habe ich. As a pianist, Mozart quickly became the darling of the Viennese public. His piano concertos were written mostly for himself to play, and he captured the hearts of the audiences with his virtuoso playing and his astonishingly rich invention. In Vienna, too, Mozart became a friend of the great Joseph Haydn, 24 years his senior. He paid Haydn the great compliment of dedicating to him a set of 6 fine string quartets. And on hearing them, Haydn said to Leopold Mozart, "Before God and as an honest man, I tell you that your son is the greatest composer known to me, either in person or by name. He has taste, and what is more, the most profound knowledge of composition." It's often illuminating to know something of the circumstances behind Mozart's compositions, and especially to know the performers he had in mind. Most of his piano concertos, as I mentioned just now, were written for himself to play. Sometimes he wrote for pupils or amateurs, and then he tended to write rather more simply. When he was writing for professional soloists, if they had any particular specialities, he'd give them plenty of opportunity to shine. The bass aria we heard earlier from Mozart's German opera Die Entführung was written for Ludwig Fischer, who could produce some amazingly low notes. And Mozart's friendship with the clarinetist Anton Stadler has given us the wonderful Clarinet Concerto. There were probably 2 things Mozart wanted above all as a professional composer. One was the opportunity to write opera. In this he was reasonably successful. In May 1786 his opera Buffa, The Marriage of Figaro, was a tremendous success, and when it travelled to Prague the audiences there clamoured for more. Mozart gave them more the following year. In October 1787, Prague was treated to the first performance of the opera Don Giovanni. The other thing Mozart wanted was a job. It was all very well to be a freelance musician, but it was insecure. To tell the truth, it had only recently become possible because public concerts were quite unknown until the 18th century. Before that, a composer could only make a living by writing for the church, the court, or the opera theatre. A job at the court would have suited Mozart right down to the ground. In 1787, he obtained one as chamber composer to the imperial court, but it was hardly worthy of his genius. All that was required of him was to write dance music for annual balls. He got the job largely because the emperor wanted to keep him in Vienna and didn't want him seeking his fortune elsewhere. If any of you have seen the film Amadeus, you'll probably be familiar with the legend that Mozart was poisoned by an envious rival, Antonio Salieri. It's true that Mozart's genius far surpassed that of Salieri, but if anything, Mozart had more reason to envy Salieri than the other way round. Salieri had exactly the job Mozart longed for, court Kapellmeister to the emperor. But Mozart would never acquire such a distinguished position, and towards the end of the 1780s, he began getting into financial difficulties. He'd been fated when he first arrived in Vienna, but the public is notoriously fickle. His personal life was not without its troubles either. Four of his six children died in infancy. Some of the sadness of this dark period in his life comes through in music of deep tragedy. By 1791, Mozart was writing begging letters to many of his friends and influential supporters. He struggled hard to gather enough commissions to pay his bills. An opportunity came through a friend and colleague to write a popular pantomime-type opera for a suburban theatre. It might sound unpromising, but in The Magic Flute, Mozart managed to produce music of extraordinary genius, despite the less-than-ideal circumstances. Dein Zauberton, weil holde Flöte durch dein Spielen selbst wilde Tiere Freude fühlen. Wie stark ist doch dein Zauberton. It's well known that the commission for a Requiem Mass came from a stranger who refused to give his name or the reason for the commission, but he was offering payment, and Mozart accepted the work. Deeply superstitious, he became convinced that he was writing the Requiem for himself. Alas, this turned out to be the case. At the time of his death, in December 1791, aged only 36, he left an unfinished score. Thanks to the notes he left behind, though, his pupil Süssmayr was able to complete the work, Mozart's final masterpiece. Thank you. can only begin to wonder what Mozart might yet have produced had he lived as long as his friend Joseph Haydn, who reached the grand old age of 77. But in his 36 years, he left us with a marvellous collection of works of genius. 41 symphonies, 30 piano concertos, 27 string quartets, and over a dozen operas, including the ones he wrote in his childhood. What he gave us is an incomparable treasure. In thanks for all that we received from him, let's remember to say a prayer for the repose of his soul.
Our thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Meanwhile, here in the Vatican, visitors continue to flock to St. Peter's. Rome has, after all, a special place in tourists' hearts. As Pope Benedict himself said on the occasion of the Mozart concert we mentioned earlier, remember, it was also the anniversary of the city's founding. His exact words were, "The vocation of Rome is to be a beacon of civilization and spirituality for the entire world." Rome, he added, has had a key role down the centuries, welcoming visitors who come to see important works of art and architecture, many of which are tied to this city's Christian history. Like, for example, and I'm adding this, not Pope Benedict, the exhibition currently taking place in the Charlemagne wing to the left of St. Peter's Square, which offers visitors a tiny hint of what the site's 4th century basilica looked like. A sampling of drawings for projects dropped, changed or executed. A glance at how other artists paid homage to St. Peter. And a brief reflection on the basilica's importance in the lives of three well-known Catholics. They are Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta, St. Francis of Assisi and St. Therese of Lisieux, whose objects and writings are a witness to the emotion of finding oneself in the cities where Saints Peter and Paul preached and were martyred. It's on the subject of this exhibition, but on a far lighter and more flippant note, that Ed and I like to focus. The next segment of this programme, as announced at the beginning, is in fact ever respectful of our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, whom I bully today into jotting down a postcard to a friend of mine named Alice. Watch the change of pace and tone. So far, Foster, this friend of mine is crazy about exhibitions like the one down the road at St. Peter's. So let's start the postcard. Ave, my friend. Right? Her name's Alice. Is Alice a Latin name?
Alicia. Alicia. Yes, in Wonderland. Alice in Wonderland. Oh, yeah.
Alice in Wonderland.
Terra Mirabilium. We have all that done. In the land of the wonders.
Well, this is the text of my postcard, Land of Wonders. To celebrate the foundation of St. Peter's birthday in 506. You translate that?
Celebrator. To celebrate what?
St. Peter's birthday.
Ah.
I mean St. Peter's Basilica.
Santi Petri Basilice Natalis.
The foundation stone.
Okay, it's the lapis angularis.
I'll buy that, lapis angularis, I like that.
Yeah, the cornerstone.
Cast in 1506.
Anno millesimo quingentesimo sexto est iactus.
That sounds very complicated, Father.
Iactus was cast. The stone was cast.
So anyway, I crossed the bridge over the Tiber.
Pontem super Tiberim transii.
And went to what was once known as the Ager, or rather Ager, perhaps, Vaticanus.
Et adii qui quondam fuit Ager Vaticanus, to keep that form.
What does Ager actually mean?
It means the Vatican plain, the Vatican field.
Orchard.
Orchard. Nah, that's a...
How do you say orchard?
Pomarium.
That means apples. But not only apple trees.
Okay, that's enough.
Going towards the Charlemagne wing.
Ad aulam Caroli Magni tendens.
Where an exhibition marking a special date is housed.
Ubi rerum expositio.
This exhibition, then, is focusing on the building of the basilica.
Hunc eventum celebrans.
Where an exhibition marking a special date is housed.
Well, I would say custoditur.
Mentioning the names of the great figures involved in the building.
Intenditur mens varia in edificationis tempora ipsius basilice. Many. Qui included clara et celebria nomina. At the end, then you have the list there.
Bernini was singled out in this exhibition by a medal with his portrait, commissioned in his honour by Louis XIV of France, where there are the words in Latin.
Well, they would have. That's the only thing they knew.
Singularis in singulis, in omnibus unicum.
No. Unicum is neuter. Oh, not unicum, unicus. He was, you'd say, he was outstanding in individual things, but he was unique in all things.
Getting back to my postcard, you won't believe it, Alicia, but there was a hotbed of envy section with all kinds of documents testifying to this.
To what?
To this hotbed of envy section.
What is the hotbed of envy? A seminarium invidiae, a seedbed of envy.
One of these documents concerned an irate Michelangelo who complained that some of his workmen were not getting paid.
Qui conquerebatur was complaining.
Michelangelo.
No, nullis Michelangelo's be.
Irate.
Iratus, or irascens.
There you are.
Irascens. Michelangelo's conquerebatur, vel querebatur. No, nullis suis opificibus mercedem non solvi.
Well, there was even a fragment taken from a dark red wall with some significant graffiti in Greek. Petrus Eni.
That's not in the exhibit there. They didn't pull it out of the basement. You're not going to touch that. A red wall there where St. Peter was, they said, was buried. Peter here, Petrus Eni.
1,800 years ago.
Yeah. Mille octingentos abinc annos.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover, his Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Make sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Laudator Jesus Christus.